This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR. Morena no mai kiti korero. Welcome to the catch up on Manawatu People's Radio. Te reo irirangi o na tangata o Manawatu. Apologies are in order. The catch up has been a bit sporadic over the past few days, mostly because I haven't been able to tee up guests. But yesterday we were intending to speak to Professor Lee Signal from Massey University, but we were going to Zoom her, and we've had a number of technical failures here at MPR, not least of which is our internet is somewhat on the intermittent side at the moment, which meant we couldn't Zoom Lee, but she is a specialist in sleep. She's part of the Sleep and Wake Research Centre in the School of Health Sciences. I'm really keen to speak to her. So if you're listening, Lee, you've been very gracious in my number of apologies. We will get you on air at some point. However, today is Wednesday. Wednesdays are media days on the catch up. And this morning we are speaking to RNZ regional reporter for Manawatu, Jimmy Ellingham, on the phone. Good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning, Fraser.
So, yes, good to have you, although you're not here. You're down in Wellington.
That's right. Yes, I'm down in Wellington filling in for another role this week. But on Monday I was in the region and have been for the past couple of weeks.
Yes, and I think we've talked previously about how sometimes these media days on the catch-up can be a little bit in the doldrums, but we've got a number of fairly sort of happy stories today, a couple of serious ones as well. But we'll start with the gorge. The old gorge route has been making headlines recently. Waka Kotahi are considering the future of the gorge, but you've been looking at how it's been used currently.
That's right. Close to traffic in April 2017, those slips came down about Anzac Day, wasn't it? And a few weeks ago now, I think just over a month ago, Waka Kotahi, New Zealand Transport Agency, said it won't be reopening to traffic. It's got a draft geotechnical report that says the risk of slips and rockfall is too great, and despite the fact that it hasn't quite been peer-reviewed, the results meant that they've decided not to reopen it for traffic, plus the new highway going across the hills between Manawatu and Hawke's Bay, which is due to open in 2024, and by the way, is looking, you can see the progress now, can't you, from the Ashur side. Anyway, it's really making a scar, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but a scar on the side of the hills as it sort of winds its way up. But I visited on Monday. I was going to go on Sunday to the old Gorge Road to have a look to see what condition it's in and how it's been used. But the weather on Sunday wasn't great. But Monday morning was a perfect day. And despite being a weekday, there were plenty of people around. Most people were using the walking track over the hills, which is the one where there's no closures. Waka Kotahi says that it doesn't advise anyone to use the old Gorge Road. But the draft geotechnical report does say if safety work were to be carried out, so some of the slips removed, some of the infrastructure there, such as bridges, assessed, then it may be okay for walkers, cyclists and horse riders. The reasoning being people in a car might not be aware that a slip is coming down, and there's a danger that they'll come around a corner at 80 k's an hour, something along those lines, and not be able to react to a slip in front of them, whereas people on foot, on horseback or on a bike will have a bit more situational awareness and won't be going as fast.
Much like any other walking track across New Zealand.
Yes, exactly. That's the case. And when I had a look in the old Gorge Road, a well-worn track has formed across those slips, and people seem to use it. There's a hole in the fence at the Ashurst end, and I've seen that's been repaired several times, but perhaps Waka Kotahi it hasn't bothered lately because the same hole's been there for, I think, a little while.
Yes, you've got to pick your fights, I think.
Stage. Yeah. And on Monday when I got there, as soon as I got to the car park by the walking tracks, there were people, quite a few people there ready to do their walk, and I spoke to as many of them as I could. Quite often, they were just about everyone I spoke to universally welcomed it, opening the old road, opening as a walking and cycling track, if it was safe. And here's a bit of a taste of what some people were telling me.
Well, as long as it's stabilised, you know, it's nice to have all these walking tracks here. I'd be more than happy to have more, and some people want to go further.
Nature will take its course, and eventually maybe it will produce stable conditions, in which case using it for another purpose would be great.
I don't think you'll see a better view anywhere.
Also, I would really like it to see, you know, the naturalness come through, forestry come back through, and for it to be left as it is and to be looked after, I think, especially because it is a historical area for Māori.
And that one about nature taking its course, I believe it already has.
Yes, there's, there's reclaiming the old road, I suppose you could say. There's a lot of growth in there and on the tarmac, and there's areas where slips have come across the road. There's also a couple of areas where there were barriers against the road to protect the road against rockfall, and it's almost like wetland areas have formed behind there where the moisture comes down off the side of the hills and can't drain across the road. And there's developing ecosystems, I guess you could say. One, I did run into a couple of Victoria University landscape architecture students who were going to walk the old road as part of their study. And one of them, a man called Brad Jonathan, he's looking at the old gorge road to see how it could be used for recreational use. And here's what he had to say.
And we are looking to do some work here at the gorge, maybe turn into a recreational trail, a biking track if need be. Look to do something with the old road along the lines of infrastructural rehabilitation, some sort of things like that. Like I said before, we don't really want to whitewash it with brand new materials and stuff. I think retaining the character of the place is really important. So we're going to do some drawings and generate some ideas, and if people like them, you know, there might be something that could happen in the future, I think, to complement this new piece of infrastructure going through here. So,
and diggers in the background as well.
Yes, it's a busy place, the car park at the Ashurst end, because you've got it's a work site and you've got plenty of workmen and machinery going, as well as all these people arriving to do their recreation. And you've had a recent look around that area too, haven't you, Fraser? What were your thoughts?
I went for a walk along the old road. It's very pretty. My only complaint really is that where they've moved the car park to is up on the side of the hill. So if you're going to go for a walk on the old road, which is quite level, and yet there are some slips there, but generally easy terrain, you've got this hellish steep walk back to the car at the very end.
Yeah, I think it's possibly the only place to put the car park, because it used to be down on the roadside, didn't it? Which is now where some of that new bridging work will go across the river at the start of the new highway. It's very pretty in there, you're right. And it actually looks really nice where the plants and the foliage has started to grow up on the road, hasn't it? And the slips have tracks across them. I didn't go to the bit in the middle, and the bit that Waka Kotahi says is the most unsafe is a 4K stretch in the middle. I didn't quite go in that far. But certainly at either end, it's a nice little stroll, isn't it? Because even the slips aren't too hard to navigate at the end anyway.
No, they're definitely not. And it seems that Waka Kotahi can take their sweet time on this, because people are going to use it regardless. But I guess the main thing for them is they kind of want this road off their books, don't they? They want to acknowledge that it is not a public highway anymore and thus not their problem.
That's right. And they've started that process that they call revocation of it as a state highway, which means they can turn it back to perhaps the local councils or other parties. They're in talks at the moment with Land Information New Zealand about the process that they can use for that. It's not a hugely quick process. New Zealand Transport Agency, Sarah Downs, who's a regional manager for Waka Kotahi, says that they want to develop a business case by the end of 2024, which is when the new road opens. So essentially, when that new road opens, Waka Kotahi wants to be able to say this is what's going to happen to the old road. I spoke to Tracy Collis, the mayor of Tararua District, which is one of the bordering authorities, and as you'd expect, she would love to see the gorge route open in some form, as, you know, it'd be a great recreational and tourist attraction, wouldn't it? She even raised the possibility that if it was potentially unsafe in the middle, to open the ends of it. And in itself, that's a nice walk, isn't it? A few Ks in and a few Ks out. The one concern Tracy Collis had is she said her ratepayer base in Tararua, it's small, and we know that they have trouble paying for roads, an infrastructure when there's storm damage as it is. So she was concerned about its ability to potentially have to pay more to do that safety work in the gorge or the regular maintenance that may be required to keep it open and keep it safe. But over the next couple of years, I think we'll see some sort of plan with that, because it can involve parties such as iwi, the Department of Conservation's another one that Tracy Collis raised that may have some interest there. So it will be very interesting to see what the Waka Kotahi's business case looks like, and to see what sort of damage there has been to some of those bridges and that roadway in there, and particularly in that middle section.
Yep, it's all going to come down to the money and who's going to pay for it, and I'm sure you'll be watching that diligently over the coming months and probably, let's be honest, years. You are listening to The Catch-Up on Manawatu People's Radio. We're speaking to Jimmy Ellingham, RNZ regional reporter for Manawatu. Another story that you covered last week, Jimmy, I believe, was the welcoming of Chatham Island restricted drivers getting their licences.
Yeah, this is quite a nice story. So in the past few weeks, about 28, I think it was, people from the Chatham Islands have been in Palmerston North to sit their full or restricted licences as part of a scheme to bring them across to New Zealand to do that, because there's nowhere in the Chathams where you can sit practical driving tests. You can take a learner's licence, which is just a theory test, but you can't actually sit your practical driver test. And as we were told, there are police on the Chatham Islands, so if you do drive around without a licence, you could be caught. And in the past couple of years, the scheme's funded by the Mayor's Task Force for Jobs and the Ministry for Social Development. The past couple of years, 100 people from the Chathams have come across to get their licences, including quite a few have come to get their higher class licences, so they're to drive trucks and hazardous material and that sort of thing. They haven't all been in Palmerston North, but this latest lot were coping with our traffic. And, I mean, Palmerston North doesn't seem too busy as a city, does it, Fraser? But I suppose when you come from a population of about 600 to 700, Palmerston North would seem quite busy.
Do they have traffic lights and roundabouts in the Chathams?
No, they don't have roundabouts, no traffic lights, and no tar seal on the roads. They're gravel roads with a limit of 80 kilometres an hour, but as the people we spoke to said, that you can't drive that fast on most of them, because they're quite windy and in some cases relatively slippery. But they did say the roads were in okay condition. They don't feel unsafe. But when they came to Palmerston North, it was a bit of a culture shock to get used to those traffic lights. And one of the men I spoke to was Colin Maxwell, and he had just passed his restricted test.
How would you describe Palmerston North driver behaviour?
Well, it was pretty difficult when I was doing mine, because whatever could go wrong went wrong. I had a van pull out in front of me and was parked sideways across the lane of the road, so... Yeah, but I had a good instructor with me, and she, just shook her head at them.
I think it's like that every day,
yeah.
And do you need your driver licence for work?
Yes, for work, and especially for dropping my son off at Kohanga. Now I can do that legally without having to look over my shoulder.
I guess my question, Jimmy, is why Palmerston North? I mean, it's great to have these people here, but is there a reason coming all the way from the Chathams to Palmy? I would have thought there would be other places that would be closer.
They have been to other places. They're just going around different places in New Zealand. And the Mayor's Task Force for Jobs, that's obviously made up of mayors, and Grant Smith is one of them, and he was keen to get them to Palmerston North and to Manawatu. And I suppose practically you'd possibly rather do it in a smaller centre such as Palmerston North compared with Auckland, wouldn't you, or Wellington or Christchurch. It might be a bit easier to sit your licence there. But they've come over here and done courses with VTNZ instructors, so they do perhaps a week. A lot of that is practical training, so they've spent many hours driving and getting used to the traffic before they sit their tests. And a man called Ian Morrison, who's the managing director of a company called Kiwis Can Do, which basically gets people skills so they can get into jobs, said that getting some of those licences that I mentioned before, the truck driving licences, the more endorsed classes, is actually essential work, because when there are projects, when there's infrastructure projects on the Chatham Islands, if the locals don't have those licences, they have to get labour in from mainland New Zealand, which seems a bit of a waste.
I'm assuming, is there a fire station in the Chathams? Because they'll need their licences for driving fire engines and things as well.
Yeah, there are emergency services on the Chathams. I'm not sure how the fire situation works. The police over there would obviously have their licences and perhaps rotate from New Zealand. I'm not sure how that works, but yeah, and I suppose ambulances too. I'm not sure if they what the state of the emergency services are there.
We need to do a deep dive into the culture and living style of the Chatham Islands. We'll leave that with you as an idea. Staying with driving related things, last time we spoke, you were speaking to residents in the Levin area around the new state highway barriers, not giving enough people enough room to move over to one side in order to access their driveways and their properties on the state highway. I drove down there last week, I think, and remember thinking there is technically enough room for a car to be on that shoulder and not be an impediment to me, but it wouldn't be pleasant.
No, and it's State Highway 57, just to the south of the Vin, on the work that's happened near the Kimberley turnoff. Some residents say that these new barriers on the side of the road mean they can't pull over to, well, they can pull over to the left, but can't safely pull over to the left before turning right or left into their properties, as you do on country or on rural roads. And it certainly seems that that is the case. New Zealand Transport Agency Waka Kotahi says there's actually more room on the shoulder there, but because the barriers there, the residents pointed out, they no longer have the option of pulling over on the verge a bit more like you might if there's a truck or something behind you. And these residents are feeling like they have to turn right and basically have traffic stop behind them while they do so, which isn't popular. However, since we did our story a few weeks ago, New Zealand's Transport Agency officials, Waka Kotahi officials, have gone and had a look in the region, and they've said that they've identified some potential improvements there. They haven't said what they are yet, but that having a look at this barrier, there are some driveways where the barrier does stop, but this, for some residents it doesn't, and so perhaps that could be what some of those improvements involve. Molly Page, who's the resident that raised these concerns with RNZ, says, well, she'll sort of believe it when she sees it, and no one's, when I checked with her a week or so ago, no one had actually come to speak to her about her concerns. The other thing I promised her to update from a couple of weeks ago is a listener sent us a New Zealand Transport Agency manual, a manual for how to use these barriers. And this manual said that in a 100-kilometre zone, which the State Highway 57 is, there should be 3 metres of clear space between the barrier and where a car can pull over. So, yeah, that you might shy away from, as the roading officials call it, the shying effect, that you don't want to park too close or stop too close to a barrier. Mm. But I checked with Waka Kotahi, and they said that while I've published those guidelines on its website, they're not strictly enforced. They are just guidelines, but they weren't followed in this case.
So we take the time to write down these things on a bit of paper so that we can be accountable and have something to reference, but then we decide we don't always have to do it.
Well, they were quite old, I think, as well. They were dating back at least 15 years, so potentially out of date and moved on.
We've got we've only got 10 minutes and we've still got plenty to get through here on the Catch Up. If you want to listen to this or previous editions of the Catch Up series, head to the website npr.nz/show/catch-up, also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your online listening. The Lake Alice story never seems to end. There seemed to be some form of at least recognition and accountability for some of the travesties that occurred during Lake Alice, but now the UN's getting involved.
Yeah, a former patient of the Child and Adolescent Unit, which is what that Royal Commission looked into last year, a man called Malcolm Richards from Hawke's Bay, he made a complaint to the UN Committee Against Torture. He's the second former patient to do so, and perhaps not surprisingly, the committee found that there was a case to answer there and has recommended that the New Zealand government investigate these claims, which I suppose it has done with that now, with that Royal Commission and a more thorough police investigation last year. Of course, there were problems with previous police investigations where nobody was charged. So it's also, the Ewing Committee has also recommended redress, so compensation, as quickly as possible. Malcolm Richards says that's an issue there, because the Royal Commission that's looking into Lake Alice, that's, the hearings are now a year ago for those, and there hasn't been a report released yet, although there is one expected later this year, which you'd expect then the government to consider. But, of course, as Malcolm Richards says, many of these people who are at that unit, which closed in the late 70s, and are now getting on in life, and the longer it takes before they can receive some sort of compensation, not just money, also, you know, they're talking about rights to counselling, rights to medical help from ongoing difficulties. The longer they have to wait for that, of course, it means that there's more suffering for them. And that's one of the things that he wants this UN decision to highlight. Malcolm Richards says if there's no movement anytime soon, he might contact the UN again and see if they could send out a special rapporteur, I think they call it, so a UN representative to come to New Zealand to see what is happening.
Oh, wow. That would be probably good from the Lake Alice victims' point of view, but I can't imagine that would be seen as a positive step by the Royal Commission and the inquiry. That's, you know, another cook in the kitchen.
Yeah, well, the Royal Commission's work, I suppose, is a bit separate to that, but it's more perhaps the government response to that. And I tried to contact offices of ministers when this report came out, and they referred me to something called the Crown Response Agency, which merely said it was aware of this. I mean, this is the UN Committee Against Torture judgment, and, you know, to merely say you're aware of it seems a little bit disengaged from the process, I feel. There were some, in that UN report, there was some interesting information too about the latest police investigation. It's the third into allegations of torture at that child and adolescent unit. And one man, a former nurse called John Corcoran, is facing charges. He's 90 years old, though, and the earliest he would face trial would be next year, which seems incredible. Two other former workers, including the head psychiatrist, Dr. Selwyn Leakes, the police said there was enough evidence to charge them, but they weren't in condition to face trial, and Selwyn Leakes died earlier this year. But there was some information about that third police inquiry in this UN report, and one of the things that it jumped out a little bit was that there were 130 children there, potentially, who received electric shock therapy as punishment. So they got electric shocks as punishment, sometimes to their genitals and other parts of their body, rather than some form of recognised medical treatment.
Mind boggles. Let's park that and move on. Mayor Helen Warboys, Manawatu District Council, obviously the sort of the chair or the champion of Communities for Local Democracy, that is opposing the government's Three Waters reform. It's probably not a good look for MDC, therefore, to find out that there's a large bill coming because the stormwater system is not as effective as it could be.
That's right. The stormwater system's been under a lot of pressure there in the past 9 months or so. There's been four floods in that time, four 1-in-50-year floods, and the council there says the stormwater system in Fielding is built to deal with a 1-in-10-year flood, so a slightly less severe one. So officials have recommended that a new stormwater system for the town is required. That will come with a price tag of $18 million. And there's no funding allocated for that, and it's expected to be in the next 10-year plan round, the 2024 to 2034 round. The Three Waters reforms that Manawatu District Council opposes, the stormwater would be one of the things that should this law pass, that one of the new entities would look after, isn't it?
Yes, it would. Well, I have my opinions on Three Waters reform, and Helen has hers, and is supported by a grand swathe of people. It does seem to be the precise case the government is making, that the councils are struggling.
Yeah, after Manawatu District Council made this announcement on Tuesday, yesterday, they put out a public statement urging people to submit to the Select Committee considering the Three Waters, the Parliamentary Select Committee considering the Three Waters reform, and obviously urging people to oppose it. But yes, as far as stormwater goes, there's a potential of an $18 million bill for ratepayers in that next 10-year plan cycle.
Mid-Central nurses, explain what's happening here. They're not happy, are they?
No, and this is working in the emergency department. So in mid-June, they issued 3 provisional improvement notices, which is an official process, the WorkSafe process, where you're concerned about health and safety and conditions at work. And it was to do with things like staff conditions, general safety, absences, pressure on staff. And the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, which supported that move, and Mid-Central have since been in talks to try to rectify the situation, and we'll be asking soon for a progress report on that. Mid-Central, for example, says staff absences in June hovered at about 10%, which is a sizable chunk of the workforce. The busiest day in ED had 134 patients on June the 16th, the quietest day 102 on June the 19th. That doesn't seem like that quiet a period of 24 hours. For one department. So those two, the nurses and Mid-Central, or it's not Mid-Central now, of course, is it? It's the new organisation, but the Mid-Central region will be working together.
Thing is, this is not surprising, and it's interesting that the nurses feel they have to fight for this when it's obvious. The stories are rife, not only in ED. I mean, we've talked about the mental health ward and the overworking of staff to the extent where patients are suffering and, in some cases, tragic events ensue.
Earlier this year, I did a story about a lady who waited a day to be seen, an elderly lady who waited a day to be seen in the emergency department. And speaking to a nurse who worked in the department, she said that it's just impossible to get through to work. And things like at the end of a shift, particularly at the end of a day shift, the usual practice or the preferred practice is to clear the backlog of patients. So, you know, a night shift or a day shift comes in without any backlog. But that's just not happening because they're just overwhelmed with numbers. Mid-Central is making extensions to the emergency department, and there's going to be a new triaging centre and that sort of thing. But it's hard to see, without a completely new department and employing many, many more staff, it's hard to see that all these bad statistics will get much better.
Indeed. Jimmy Ellingham, we are completely out of time on the catch-up this morning, but thank you for joining us and telling us what you've been reporting on in the past couple of weeks.
Thank you, Fraser.
There we go. Jimmy Ellingham from RNZ on the catch-up this morning. We will endeavour to have a catch-up tomorrow morning as well, but we will definitely have one on Friday. MP for Rangitiki, Ian McKelvey, will be joining us via the phone again. Have a great day. Enjoy the rest of your day. Join us tomorrow or Friday at 8:30. Bye for now. If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.